department here at Cornell. Thank you for coming. Welcome to Ithaca. I would like to associate to this wonderful event the other institution where Bill Thurston spent some very important part of his career. Berkeley, of course, Princeton, MSRI, Mathematical Science Research Institute in Berkeley, and University of California at Davis. I'm very pleased to introduce Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Science, Barbara Baird, who is going to welcome you. Thank you.
Gretchen Ritter is traveling today, and I was happy to accept her invitation to come in her place this morning. The College of Arts and Sciences at Cornell University welcomes you. It is my pleasure to initiate this conference, What's Next? The Mathematical Legacy of Bill Thurston. Before coming today, I had the opportunity to learn a little bit more about Bill Thurston, who lived in Ithaca with his family during 2003 to 2012 while he thought and taught in mathematics at Cornell. I was saddened again by the terrible loss of his life at the age of 65. I got another glimpse of the beauty of what he accomplished in mathematics and the impact that his work continues to have, as represented by this conference and all of you who are attending today. I am a chemist, not a mathematician, and can only get the simplest sense of Bill Thurston's geometrization, conjecture, foliation, and three manifolds, or his other contributions that will be discussed during this conference. Even so, Bill Thurston's words brings the wonder of his thoughts. So I'll close my few remarks here with some of his words. And I think these ring true, not only for mathematics, but also for scholarship at the highest level in any area. So here are some of Bill Thurston's words that I read over the weekend. It is easy to forget that mathematics is primarily a tool for human thought. The most important thing about mathematics is how it resides in the human brain. When mathematics loses its connection to our minds, it dissolves into a haze. In mathematics, what is intriguing, puzzling, interesting, surprising, boring, tedious, exciting is crucial. They are not incidental. They shape how we think. I think there'll be a lot of thinking and talking and excitement about mathematics, and I wish you all of this as you continue with the conference. Again, welcome to Cornell to celebrate Bill Thurston and his legacy in mathematics. I now program to Karen Bowman, who will.
Thank you very much, Barbara. Welcome, everybody. We have a really exciting lineup of activities and events this week. So I don't really want to spend much time. I want to dispense with the announcements and just get started. So our first speaker today is Yair Kuminsky. He's going to talk about relative and absolute bounds on Thurston's skinny maps.
Thank you. Can you hear me? I probably should not shout. Okay. So I wanted to thank the organizers of the conference for having this amazing event with so many people. I'm really looking forward to all the talks after the first one. This is really loud. So it's really a pleasure and a privilege to be here with all of you and all these so many people that I know, and I think people I also don't know. It's also melancholy to think that we're here to remember Bill and that he is not here with us. and that we can't, he can't be part of this, and we can't wonder to ourselves the way we used to wonder, what mathematics is he going to do next? And that brings me to the title of the conference, What's Next?, which I find kind of intimidating. So, you know, who am I to answer this question? So I don't really have an answer, but I have a story which I stole from Dick Canary, who is not here, so he can't do anything about it. So when Dick was a graduate student with me in the mid-80s, he had done some work with David Epstein at Warwick, and he was ready to think about, you know, his thesis research, and he went into Bill and asked him if, you know, what he should be reading, what he could be, you know, getting started on looking at. And Bill looked at him as if this was the strangest question that a student could ask his advisor. And he said, go to the library, look around, see what's interesting. So that turned out to be pretty good advice, actually. And I think this is somehow the point of view of mathematics that Bill has always promoted, that it's mathematics is about patterns and structures, and what interests us is the best guide to what we should do, what we should be thinking about. Okay, so so I'm just going to tell you stuff that I like to think about. And one of the things, well, let me see, let me figure out how the board works now.
Fat chalk.
Okay, so why is this here?
That's for colors.
Okay. All right. Okay, good. Maybe I'll start in the middle. Okay. So, what I want to talk about today is Thurston's skinning map. Which is a mapping of Teichmuller spaces that Thurston introduced a long time ago as part of his proof of hyperbolization of Hocken 3 manifolds. And it's the map which is behind the fixed point problem which Thurston stated in order to solve the gluing problem that's the inductive step of the hyperbolization theorem. And although there appears now to be a different proof of the hyperbolization theorem, nevertheless, the structure that was introduced here, I think, is interesting in its own right, and a better quantitative understanding of how this map actually works can give us more quantitative understanding of the way that hyperbolic manifolds are structured and the way that their hyperbolic geometry is related to their topological descriptions. So that's sort of the theme. The thing that interests me in general is this interaction between topological or combinatorial aspects of three manifolds and their geometric aspects, and that's on the level of individual manifolds, and the interaction of this with the deformation theory of these manifolds, the spaces of structures. And I think this is one of the ways, I mean, thinking about these things altogether is one of Thurston's big innovations. So I want to spend a while telling you how this works, and I'm hoping that with this kind of audience, probably 100 people already know everything I'm going to say, and maybe another 100 people don't, so I'll do my best. So let me start with the gluing problem. By the way, is this good volume? Am I speaking at a reasonable? Should I speak louder or?
Good.
This is good. Good. Okay. Excellent. So the gluing problem. So suppose you have two manifolds, M1 and M2. These are compact three manifolds. Let's say orientable because I don't want to get into trouble. Irreducible. And atoroidal. Three manifolds. And the gluing is, well, and we assume they have boundary, and we think about a homeomorphism that identifies the boundaries, and we want to, and then let's let the glued-up manifold. So take the manifold that you get by gluing the two boundaries together, and in the inductive step of the hyperbolization theorem, you want to start with hyperbolic structures on these, and conclude that there exists a hyperbolic structure on this. Okay, and that's how the skidding map comes into play. And my goal in the end, I guess, is to talk about how well we can turn this into a quantitative discussion. So what is it that we do? So first of all, I guess we, in order for M to be, so the theorem is, for simplicity, let's assume there are no tori in the boundary. So let's assume also no tori in the boundary. So these are higher genus surfaces that we're gluing. And for the discussion, it's also better to just think of a single boundary component, just to make it a simple picture. And the theorem is if M admits, well, if M is a toroidal, so if M1, M2 admit hyperbolic structures, and M is a toroidal, then M admits a hyperbolic structure. And a special case of this is if M1, so in particular, if M1 and M2 have no essential annuli, then M is hyperbolic for any gluing map. So the picture you should have in mind is this. Here's a manifold, M1, with some boundary, and here's M2. And there's a map that identifies the two boundaries together. And by the way, for convenience later, it's a good idea to think of the map as an involution. So you can also define it not just from this boundary to this boundary, but also going the other way. Okay, so the inverse of phi is a map defined with the other domain, and we just call that phi as well. Anyway, we have this identification, and phi and the structure of the manifold determines whether or not M has essential tori. But in particular, if there are no essential annuli on either side, then there can't be any essential tori. So it's sort of one direction is obvious, right? If you have an annulus here, and not essential annulus, and you have an annulus there, for example, and the map happens to glue them together, then you'll get a torus. So in general, you have to make sure the map doesn't do that, but if there are no annuli, then you're fine. So, yeah. Oh, I forgot. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. So, boundary MI Okay. So, I should quickly say what these words mean. So, this means the fundamental group of the boundary injects into the fundamental group of the manifold. This means there are no non-trivial spheres. This means there are no pi 1 injective tori, except possibly for boundary components. But we said specifically there were no boundary components that were tori. So, okay, that's not the most general theorem one could state, but it's good enough for this discussion.
Do you want to impose any assumptions on the hyperbolic structures of M1 and M2?
I guess it depends on which exact theorem one wants to state, right? But you're right, I should say. So I want convex co-compact, right? Right, and I want to talk a little bit about what that means. I mean, the fact is, if they admit any hyperbolic structure, they also admit a convex co-compact one. But I suppose that one didn't know that a priori.
The way.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So when I say, it's a good question. So what do I mean by a hyperbolic structure on a compact manifold? And what I mean is a complete hyperbolic metric on the interior of the manifold. Okay? And let me tell you what I mean by convex co-compact, because we'll need that too. So what is a convex co-compact hyperbolic structure? Okay, so it's the following. It's an identification. Well, let me say it this way. So I want there to be a hyperbolic manifold that's identified with M, on some manifold. So let's say on N. I want a hyperbolic manifold, which is the interior of N, but I want to say a little bit more. So I'll say it as follows. I want an identification of the fundamental group of M, of N, with a subgroup of PSL2C, which is the isometry group of hyperbolic 3 space, with the following extra structure. So if you think about how such a discrete group, this has to be a discrete group. So gamma acts not just on hyperbolic 3 space, but also on the Riemann sphere, which is the boundary of infinity of hyperbolic 3 space. And it acts dynamically, it acts with a chaotic part and a non-chaotic part, a regular part. So I can decompose the sphere into an open set and a closed set. And here, the action is a properly discontinuous, so a discrete action. And here, the action is minimal. Can everybody see what I'm writing? I apologize for. Maybe I'll go over here. Okay, so the group acts on two spaces. It acts on hyperbolic space and it acts on the sphere at infinity. And there's a homeomorphism let's say F from N, and N now is a compact manifold, to H3 union this domain modulo the group, which induces induces the map on fundamental groups. What this does is it takes the interior of N to the hyperbolic 3 space modulo gamma. That's a complete hyperbolic 3 manifold. But it also takes the boundary of N to this Riemann surface, which is omega modulo gamma. Okay, and once you draw a picture of this, here's a sort of typical picture. So here is hyperbolic 3 space union the Riemann sphere. And in this picture, you should imagine the following. The limit set may contain, for a typical example, many Jordan curves, countably many Jordan curves. Okay. All right, you get the idea. It's countably many Jordan curves. The limit set is the closure of the union of these curves I've drawn. So I have the closure of a countable collection of Jordan curves. And then in this case, the domain of discontinuity are the disks, the union of open disks, like this. Okay? And the quotient of this whole picture on the sphere, you have to throw away the limit set. The quotient of this union of disks is a Riemann surface which is identified with the boundary of N. Okay? So the co-compact part of convex co-compact corresponds to the fact that this manifold is compact. Okay, this quotient is compact. A priori, it could be that omega might be empty, for example. I could have a discrete group for which omega is empty, and then when I do this thing, I just get an open three-manifold without boundary. But our condition is that it should be convex co-compact. Okay. So let me try to finish explaining what the story is. So how does Thurston approach this theorem? So we're given two manifolds with boundary that admit such a structure, and then we need to fit them together to make a manifold, to make the glued up manifold and give it a structure as well. Okay? Which means we have to be able to deform the structures on these two manifolds so that they fit together. We have to do something to match up a priori different structures that don't fit together. And to do that, we have to understand the deformation space of all such structures. And the theorem here, and this is due to Alfords and Bears, depends on how much of this theorem I state. There are various pieces of this, which are due to Martin and Maskett and Craw and Sullivan and Thurston. So I probably will not state all the contributions of all these people in what I want to state here. I just want to state a small part of this theorem. I'd also like to point out an important feature which I like about this, which is that the alphabetical and the chronological orders are very nearly the same. So I never have to think about. So you don't have to worry about whether I can't alphabetize or whether I can't remember the order, the chronological order, one way or the other. Okay, so the theorem is that the space of these structures can be identified with the Teichmuller space of the boundary. Okay, with the assumptions that we gave, this is basically the right thing. And this identification is as nice as you want. It's a homeomorphism. Both these spaces come with a natural topological structure. In fact, they come with a complex structure. So, and this, you should think of this space of structures as living inside, the representation variety, or actually the character variety, So in order to deform these structures, and when we deform them, we mean we're deforming inside this. I mean, you can see that there's a representation of the group into PSL2C, and within all the possible representations are the ones that correspond to convex co-compact structures. This is a quotient by conjugacy in PSL2C, or if one is being very careful to make it a variety, you have to take the geometric invariant theory quotient, and you get the character variety. But the main point here is that because it lives inside this fairly nice object, it has a natural topology, and on the other hand, it can be identified with the Teichmuller space of the boundary. So what's going on here is that you can go to this picture, and first of all, you notice that there is a Riemann surface structure on this in here. If you take omega mod gamma, the action of gamma is by conformal maps, and therefore this quotient is a Riemann surface. On the other hand, what Alfords and Bears showed was that you could, given one of these, you could deform the conformal structure to obtain any other one. And this is,
When you take that quotient, isn't there going to be a point where this thing is not a manifold?
So you mean when I take the quotient of this? So the point of, so the set omega is the set where gamma acts properly discontinuously. And as long as it has no fixed points, there will not be any problematic points, as long as it acts freely. So with the assumptions that I gave, the group pi 1 of n will have no finite order elements, and so there will be no fixed points.
What's going to happen to lambda when you do this?
It's gone. I took it away. So lambda, there's no such quotient. I can't take this quotient. This is not an interesting topological space. It's a mess because gamma acts minimally.
Wedge of spheres or something. If you did that, okay. So that's not what you're doing.
It's not what I'm doing. I'm throwing this away. And so what I'm left with is the interior of the ball and an open set on the boundary. And those together, that is some kind of manifold with boundary on which I act properly discontinuously, and the quotient is a compact manifold with boundary.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is where we try to deform the manifold. So maybe after all this, I should tell you what the skinning map is. Let's see where we go next. So in order to describe the skinning map, let's do a special case. Suppose N is a surface of genus of some, this is a surface of genus at least 2 across an interval, then I should give this a name. Let's call this CC of N for convex co-compact. So the convex co-compact structures on this manifold are the Teichmuller space of the boundary, which is a product of 2 Teichmuller space, one of S and one of S with the opposite orientation coming from the 2 sides of this product. The way one studies this involves passing to this special case. In particular, if S is the boundary of some manifold, maybe now one of our manifolds, M1, maybe, there's a cover of M1 associated to the fundamental group of S. So the fundamental group of S injects into the fundamental group of M by our assumption, and we get a covering, therefore, M. I don't want to carry this index through. Oh well. There's a covering associated to this fundamental group. So this covering turns out to, in fact, be just S cross R. And in fact, the structure that you get, if you started with a convex co-compact structure here, you get a convex co-compact structure there. And this is a theorem. This is a lemma, I guess, in Thurston's paper. So this covering map, we'll maybe call it pi. So pi induces, we'll call it maybe pi star, from the convex co-compact structures on M to the convex co-compact structures on S cross R, or S, I guess this product, which is a product of Teichmuller space. On the other hand, this is also identified with a single Teichmuller space, right? So a structure here is controlled by a conformal structure on the boundary of M1. And then the structure here is determined by 2 conformal structures. And in fact, if you think about the way this map works, it looks like this. If you start with conformal structure on S, what you get is a pair of conformal structures, one of which is the one you started with, and the other is something else. So this map is called a skinning map, the map that goes, that takes x to the second coordinate. So I want to say it this way. Sorry. Okay, this defines the skinning map. one should really draw a picture of this. The picture is this, and this is sort of why Thurston called it a skinny map. So this is, here is M1 with some structure X on the boundary at infinity and some topology inside here. And when we lift it to the cover, so when you unwrap everything in M1, you get a structure on this cover, M1 hat, which is just a product manifold. You still see the same X, the X lifted homeomorphically. But on the other side, it's a non-compact manifold, but it has this boundary at infinity. And that boundary is the skinning image of X. So you've to see the skinning image, you should peel away the skin of the manifold here and look to the other side, look inside. And this is what you'll see. Okay. And in this, and it's also worth, if you haven't looked at this thing before, it's a good idea to think about it in this picture. So in this picture in the universal cover, where are all the details of this map? So if I, so any one of these, so the omega is a countable union of little disks, omega n, all of which are taken to each other by elements of the group, but the stabilizer of any one of them is the fundamental group of the surface. Okay? So the way to see this map in the universal cover is the following. You deform the structure until you get X, let's say here. So the quotient of this one by its stabilizer is X. So you look at, so suppose you take this picture and you let gamma naught be the stabilizer of maybe gamma 1 of omega 1, which is isomorphic to the fundamental group of the boundary. And if you look in H3 union, let's just say, if you look at the quotient by just gamma 1, what will you see? Well, on the inside, if you mod up by gamma 1, you get X. And then the limit set of gamma 1 is this quasi-circle that's the boundary of omega 1. And everything on the outside is in the domain of discontinuity of gamma 1. And so the quotient by gamma 1 has one, the quotient of this disk, which is X, and the quotient of everything on the other side, which is Y, the skinning image of X. So the picture that you get sort of looks like this. There's X on this side. And on the other side, you see all the other stuff, a whole bunch of disks. Right? These are all disks, which are the images of all these disks by the group gamma, by the quotient by gamma 1. And it's this structure that you get here, which is the skinny image of X. Okay, so.
You were assuming that
you had an asymmetrical situation? I was. By the time I drew the picture, I was. But I shouldn't, I didn't say it. So. That's right. They would become annuli if there were annuli in the manifold. And this is important, in fact. So I, at the end, I wanted to state something that involving the cylindrical case as well. But for the moment, let's make it acylindrical. So remember that I said in the beginning that if the manifold is acylindrical, then we don't have to worry about tori, and we know that there's going to be a, we want to prove that no matter what phi is, there's a solution to the gluing problem. Okay, so that's the picture. This is Thurston's picture. These things are called leopard spots. I think that's Bill's. Is that Bill's, Kurt? That's Bill's notation? Leopard spots, right.
Leopard spots and zebra stripes. I believe that terminology was actually due to me.
To you? Okay.
I came
to the right place.
Leopard spots and zebra stripes.
Wait, so zebra stripes are in the case of, in the annular case?
Yeah. Or,
I'm glad to hear it.
Stripes.
That's great. Okay. Okay, so let me try to quickly say, so let's go back to how does this then give us, how does this relate to the gluing problem, okay? Before I try to say anything else. So suppose let's go back to the picture where we're trying to glue two manifolds together. So suppose you have M1 and M2 Now this is a schematic cartoon. And we want to find a structure that allows them to be put together. If we could, so let's take the cover. For each of them, there's the corresponding cover associated to the surface. So let's look at that cover here. So this is supposed to be a surface cross interval. This is M1 hat. And this is supposed to be another one, M2 hat. And we are supposed to be identifying the boundaries via an involution. And so there is, of course, going to be some kind of, let's call it phi star, induced identification of this manifold with that manifold. That's just the lift of this one. Because these surfaces are, you know, they're the same surface after you identify. So what we need in order to solve the problem, we need these two manifolds to be isometric to each other. Because if this was, so I ran out of room, if these actually did fit together, then I would have the full manifold here, M, and there would be covering maps associated to the two sides. So this is the full diagram you should think of. There's this glued up manifold after you identify the surfaces. Each side separately lifts to a cover, which if there was a structure here, there would be a structure here, and if there's a structure here, there'd be a structure there, and so on. So if we were to solve the problem, then these two manifolds would have to be isometric. And it turns out that the opposite is also true. If we can just make these two manifolds isometric, then it's possible to put together these manifolds. So the question becomes, can we make these two manifolds the same? But not just the same, they should be identified by an isometry that's determined by this map phi star. Okay, so what exactly is going on? Suppose that, these guys are determined by their conformal boundary. So let's call this one x and this one y. And if I were to lift up here, I would see x here and I would see y here. And then on the other side, I would see the skinning image of x and y. So this side is sigma m1 of x, and this side is sigma m2 of y. And in order for these to be the same, it must be true that phi star takes this pair of invariants to this pair of invariants. So what we need then is, given x and y, we need phi star of sigma m1 of x should be y, and vice versa, phi star of sigma m2 of y equals x. Okay, so it's a fixed point problem. You start with the pair xy, and you do this thing to it, and I guess you could flip the coordinates, and you should get back xy. So there's some map on Teichner space which is supposed to have a fixed point in order for us to win. Okay, this is in order to. I chose phi to be an involution here, so that I don't have to write phi inverse all the time. Okay. So how does the solution to the problem work? So Thurston proved two things. One, the skinning map for any of these manifolds is contracting. And two, the image. And this is, let me be very clear. Here we assume that M I are acylindrical. Okay, so there are no annuli. This theorem becomes false as stated in general. We have to be careful. So for an acylindrical manifold, well, this part's not so bad. Anyway, so you have contraction of this map, and you also know that the image is bounded. And so what does contracting mean? Contracting means that at any point the derivative has norm strictly less than 1. And if you know that and you know that the image is bounded, then you can start to iterate the map. And uh, so So now iterations converge to a fixed point. And I should mention Kurt's great simplification of this argument. So McMullen proved that, in fact, sigma I is uniformly contracting. Which means that the derivative is strictly less than 1 by something, by a constant, which is uniform over the Teichmuller space. And that actually obviates the need for the second part, which was a large part of Thurston's proof, because as soon as it's uniformly contracting, then it's immediate that iterations converge to a fixed point. However, it's actually this part that I want to talk about. One question that I've been interested in for a while is how can we make this theorem more quantitative? So here's a question. Is there a bound on the diameter of the skinning image? So now I'm trying to simplify the notation. M is just a manifold boundary, S is its boundary. So is there a uniform bound on this diameter? So that's a naive question one could ask.
Uniform, so
the first question is there a uniform bound period over all examples, over all manifolds? To which the answer is no. So
with the assumption asymmetric.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. So yeah, it's not bounded at all unless it's acylindrical. So among acylindrical manifolds, you could ask, is this uniformly bounded? And the answer is no. Richard Kent gave very explicit examples in which the bound goes to infinity. But that's maybe that was a stupid question. I mean, why should it be uniformly bounded? So let's try again. That's how it goes, right? That's how you decide which questions were stupid. Anyway, so question two is there a bound depending only on the genus of S? Okay, so somebody gives you a genus 7, and you think about all acylindrical manifolds with genus 7 boundary, and all of their, now you're at least in a single Teichmuller space. There's one Teichmuller space, but an infinite number of maps, and you could ask, is there a uniform bound on their images? I don't know the answer to this question, but I want to tell you a little bit about some evidence in this direction. Maybe that's, yeah. So I sort of believe the answer is yes to the second question, although I don't know if I can strongly believe it, but I think it has a chance. I should maybe say something about why one should ask this question in the first place. So,
Are there examples showing the diameter can go to zero for each genus?
Yes.
Repeat the question, please.
Sorry, the question was, are there examples where the diameter goes to zero? I think combining work of Kent and Bromberg and Dumas. Let's see. So Kent and Bromberg showed that there are examples where the diameter can go to zero. And Kent and Dumas, on the other hand, showed that the map is never constant. So you never actually get diameter equal to zero, but it can be as small as you like. And then I'll give you a theorem also. I'll give you a few partial results in this direction. So let me say some partial results. So, but we need... Actually, before I say the partial results, let me point out another nice structural point that comes from this picture. So there's a special structure, there's a special point in the Teichmann space for each skinning map. And that's the following theorem. So this, I guess, is due to Bill and to Kurt. I'm not sure what exact combination. You can correct me. There exists a unique structure on M. This is, again, with the same assumptions, with totally geodesic boundary. So I'm being a little loose with the terminology. So the boundary that I was talking about here is at infinity, and it's not part of the Riemannian manifold, it's at infinity. But what I mean here is that, i.e., the quasi-circles are circles in the boundary group is Fuchsian. The uniqueness follows from Mostow, and the existence follows from the same machinery as proved. So, right. So, I don't know if this counts as a theorem or an observation. I think it's a theorem. I mean, so you have to, so in this case, you can use this, the point of this is you apply this theorem to the double of M along its boundary. And the double of M, what?
Why don't you just call that a
corollary? Corollary, that's a good idea. Can I erase everybody? That would be great. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a corollary.
Right. This is one of the things about graduate school. When you're in graduate school, there's all these ideas floating around your head and all these people saying them. And then even 20 years later, that's how it is. Right? Okay, so anyway, the argument is you double M, that admits a hyperbolic structure, but the map that exchanges the two sides is an isometry by Mostow rigidity, and therefore the boundary between them must have been totally geodesic. So the picture you get over here is the same as before, except all of these quasi-circles are round circles, and this group gamma 1 is a Fuchsian group. So you should sort of maybe have the following cartoon in mind. Inside my manifold with a boundary at infinity, there's also a totally geodesic surface. So here's x, the boundary at infinity, and there's a totally geodesic surface here, which is the boundary of a core of this manifold. And in fact, the conformal structure on this is also x. And for this, maybe we'll call it x naught, so it's like a special point in the Teichmann space. And note that sigma m of x naught, in this case, because this is a Fuchsian group, the other side is just the complex conjugate of x naught. So up to complex conjugation, this is a fixed point of the skinning map. So it's like a special point one should look at. And the geometry is somehow, it's canonically determined by the topology, so it's worth thinking about that structure. So with regard to this structure, we can make some statements. So let me make one more definition. So let's define D of M. So M here is our manifold with boundary, to be the width of largest embedded collar of the geodesic boundary. So for given M, you find the structure with geodesic boundary, you find the biggest regular neighborhood around it that's a product. Well, this here you can go on forever, but on this side you might get, at some point you get stuck, and we'll call that D. Okay? So this is some feature of the manifold. So here's some results. Um, So this is related to the first no answer. This is a result of Richard Kent. Let me say it informally. If d of m is small, then the diameter of the skinning map of m is large. And stated more carefully, if you have a sequence of acylindrical manifolds for which this d goes to 0, then the diameters will go to infinity. And if you're looking for a reason why that's true, if you look over here, if d was very small, what it would mean is that two of these circles are actually very close to each other. It ends up looking like this. So this is one of them, say omega 1, and here's another one, omega 2, and then all the other ones are stuck inside here. If d is very small, you get a picture that looks like this, and in the skinny map, somehow a deformation on this side becomes immediately visible on the other side. That's the intuition for why this should be true. So that tells you that there's no uniform upper bound. However, note, if the genus of S is bounded above, then D of M is bounded below. So this is a geometric point, which is not hard to see, but I won't belabor it. So the only way to have this picture where the two geodesic surfaces get very close together is if they have very large area and therefore very large genus. So if we were to fix the genus, we could not make d of m small. Okay, and therefore, this is relevant only if we don't fix the genus. Okay, so that's one result. Here's another one. So how else could you imagine that you would bound this diameter? So this is another theorem of Richard Kent. If the volume of, well, gosh, I need a name for everything here. Let's let this subset be called M naught. This is the core of M. You cut off along the totally geodesic boundary, everything on this side, what's left is compact. So there's this compact submanifold with totally geodesic boundary. And its volume, if this volume is bounded, then the diameter sigma m is bounded. Okay, so again, if you fix a bound on this, then you obtain a bound on this. That doesn't sound maybe so surprising, because when you bound the volume of the manifold, you're almost restricting yourself to a finite number of examples. And if that were the case, it would be obvious, but it's not quite true, because what can happen if you have a sequence of examples with fixed bound on volume, then the only thing that can happen is they can develop cusps. They can converge to manifolds with cusps of finite volume. And so you have to just understand how the skinning map behaves under that kind of convergence. So there's some kind of continuity argument to make about the skinning map for a sequence of convergent examples. So somehow we have to think about what happens if d of m is not small and we have to allow the volume to get large. What else can go wrong? So, yeah.
Question or comment? Isn't it true that if we allow cusps inside m, then we can get examples where the skinning map is constant?
I don't think so. Well, I don't know such examples. This is relevant to the thing I want to state next, but you have to sort of cusp the boundary itself. But you want cusps somewhere inside so that.
If the answer is not immediately yes.
It's not immediately obvious to me. Yeah, that's a good question, though. Maybe you're right. But there's a related statement, which is related to this pinching effect, and this is a theorem of Kent and Bromberg. And it says the following. So it says, so what could go wrong in a sequence of examples with fixed genus? One of the things that can go wrong is that the structure on the boundary on X naught could degenerate in a sequence of examples. And so what's the worst thing that can happen? What's the worst thing maybe that could happen? You could develop a network of very short curves So that X naught becomes like a bunch of triply punctured spheres attached along short curves. And when that happens, we have a bound. So if, let me try to be more careful about the quantifiers here. So given epsilon, there exists a delta, given S, so the surface and epsilon. So there exists a delta such that if M, well, if the surface X naught has a Pantz decomposition, a maximal curve system of length, total length, less than delta, then the diameter of the skinning image is less than epsilon. So if this surface is extremely pinched, what that means is that the surface is very close to being rigid itself, then the skinning map is also rigid. So various kind of directions in which things can degenerate can be explored in this way. So what's left? Well, what's left, of course, is allowing the volume to get big. Maybe we don't make things pinch in this way, so maybe we... So kind of the opposite of this condition is... So here's a question. What if X naught has no short curves? And, well, I'd like to say the volume is large, but I don't know what to say in that general setting. But what if the collar neighborhood was large? So there are certainly many examples of this type. You can keep the conformal structure of X naught bounded in the moduli space of surfaces, but somehow you get bigger and bigger. You can make fatter and fatter manifolds where there's a collar neighborhood that's larger and larger. Certainly the volume would go to infinity, so you're not covered by this example. You're also not covered by this because you have no short curves. So this might be a way to look for flexible examples. So I'm stating it this way because the answer is that they're, well, because the answer is the opposite. So I see I'm not going to get to the... There was another discussion about relative bounds, which I'll maybe leave off. But so let me at least state this one theorem with Richard Kent. And this one, let me say a little bit carefully. So given epsilon, let's see, I want to be careful here. There exists a D naught and an A such that if... Oh, and I guess I should fix the genus of the surface, so S. So if M is acylindrical, hyperbolic, boundary of M is S, and then X naught is the same totally geodesic structure, so I want the injectivity radius of X naught bigger than epsilon, so no short curves, and I want the collar to be at least some definite amount, then the diameter of the skinning map of M is very small. In fact, it's exponentially small in the distance of the in the width of the collar boundary. And maybe I'll draw a cartoon of the proof in a second, but a couple of things I wanted to say. So one thing is so this is positive evidence for the question, right? The question was, is there a uniform bound? And this says, if we try to make things blow up in this way, then we're still bounded. There are other ways to make, you can make manifolds in which, although there's no collar neighborhood for the boundary, no big collar neighborhood, still there's some kind of handle structure that's non-trivial, and the volume could be very large. So this does not answer the question completely, but at least it's positive evidence. So that's one comment about this. And I want, well, I wanted to say a little bit more about why this question is interesting to me, and I won't really say anything except to say that once you have such a bound, you can sort of, it gives you this an understanding of an infinite class of manifolds. If you start with, if you fix the surface S and you look at all manifolds, acylindrical manifolds, say, that are glued up along S, then what this kind of thing would tell you is that the structure of the corresponding covering spaces, right, is controlled. Well, I mean, the right-hand side lives essentially in the skinning image of one side, and the left-hand side lives in the skinning image of the other side. So the set of all surface manifolds that you get as covers of such manifolds, as soon as you know the diameters of these two sets, then although you don't know the exact point, you control the geometry of these covers based only on the properties of the map phi, the gluing map. Now suddenly you have this combinatorial map phi, and the geometry of the skinning images is bounded a priori. Once that's the case, then what kicks in is this combinatorial theory that tells you how to control the interior of a hyperbolic manifold directly from the of this type, directly from the conformal structures of the boundaries. Let me not belabor this point. But that was my motivation for this question. Is trying to understand these covers without knowing anything a priori about these manifolds. Okay. Do I have a minute, or am I done?
Five minutes.
Okay. Okay. So having stated this, let me kind of draw a cartoon of the proof of this theorem. And I should say the Bill and Kurt's work on this was focused at infinity and used the quasi-conformal picture that I drew here in order to explain, in order to get bounds on this map. And whereas this theorem relies on a more interior differential geometric ideas. So. Okay, so here's the cartoon of the proof. So suppose you're given a picture of this type. So what do you actually see? Here's the manifold with totally geodesic boundary. Okay, and on this side you have what looks like a Fuchsian group, and then you have X naught as a conformal structure on the outside, and there's a huge collar of size d, where d is very large. And what we know about the geometry of this is that as long as we're in a collar, what's going on is that there's a foliation by equidistant surfaces, and they grow exponentially fast. And there's kind of a nice picture due to Epstein and Martin. That kind of quantitatively describes the geometry of these surfaces and how they tend toward the surface at infinity. It happens in both directions, but let's focus on the inside. Okay, so this is like our base point, and now we want to understand, our goal is to replace X naught by something else, by Y, and then look on the other side and see that we control what the other side looks like. So here's the idea. You build this quasi-Fuchsian group, let me draw it carefully, the one which is uniform, which gives you X naught on this side, and whatever you're, no, I'm doing this backwards. I want X naught bar on this side, which is the inside structure for this one, and whatever Y is that I would like to replace X naught by on this side. So there exists a quasi-Fuchsian group like this. It's got a lot of complicated geometry on the inside, but it has a convex core, and inside, and then it has a bunch of equidistant surfaces like this. Okay, they go off to infinity, and at infinity they converge to X naught bar. Okay, this is a good place to have colored chalk for the last 2 minutes. So you go out distance d here, and you build, and you look at a little collar neighborhood of size 1 here, and you go out distance d here, and you find a collar neighborhood of size 1. Maybe go at distance d minus 1, just not to go too far. And these are very similar looking to each other because they are coming close to this. The structure infinity here is x naught bar, and the structure infinity here is x naught bar. So you expect this and this to be nearly the same, and then you identify them. So what you do is, so the cartoon is, you cut away this stuff. So let's see. You cut away this part, and you cut away this part, and you glue this compact manifold to this end, I guess, with the overlap of the red thing. And I get a new manifold, homeomorphic to the old one, with conformal structure Y at the end. And it's not, but it's not hyperbolic. Because these red strips were not exactly the same, they were just approximately the same. So the idea is to say that this is nearly hyperbolic. This is a nearly hyperbolic structure. And then to get to the true hyperbolic structure, you need a deformation theorem. And the one you need is, there's a theorem by Tian, sort of an obscure theorem actually, but that says that if you have a manifold where there's appropriate control of the curvatures and of the average curvature, so not only, or the total, so you look at this is almost constant curvature everywhere except in the red region. In the red region, you've made some kind of distortion. If the distortion is sufficiently small, then this is close to the true hyperbolic metric. Okay, so this is a cartoon, and it's a lie in a number of ways. The main way, yeah, I'm really out of time, so let me just say, so the main way in which this is a lie is that the control you get from the Epstein-Mardin equidistant surfaces is not sufficiently good to make this work. You need, and one of the problems is that the volume of the bad region is growing exponentially with D. And there's whatever error you manage to control, it's happening on an exponentially large region. And it's hard to, anyway, these surfaces are in fact only C1, and so you can't get control of curvature using these surfaces. So I guess the solution is to change the Epstein. This is the wrong Epstein. So there's this is David Epstein, but you should go and talk to Charlie Epstein, who, when he was a postdoc with Thurston, worked out a different kind of foliation by surfaces of the end, which is controlled in a much more analytic way by the Schwarzian derivative of univalent maps that describe the conformal structure. And because of that added control, you do get enough control of the curvatures here in order to make this argument work. So I'll stop there.
So does anybody have more questions?
Yeah, so it's not. So you need two things for Tian's theorem. You need to be epsilon pinched for a small epsilon, so the curvatures everywhere should be uniformly close to minus one. You also need a kind of total control. So you need the traceless Ricci tensor measures locally the difference from being. If the traceless Ricci tensor were zero, you would have an Einstein metric, which is a hyperbolic metric in this case. So what Tian needs is that the L2 norm of the traceless Ricci should also be very small. And that means that whatever your error is, you should integrate it over the entire bad region, and that is supposed to be small too. And there's a problem here that the bad region, the error is exponentially small, and the region is exponentially big. So you have to get a little bit lucky. But actually, so Tian's theorem actually is stated for LP bounds. And so if L2 doesn't work, you could just increase to some large P, and then it turns out that the volume loses. And you get the time. Yes?
So if I quickly gather that you have a real alternative to applying combination theory, that you're actually able to move these systems settled.
So that, no, I have nothing new to say about that. That's, I mean, so when Bill did this, he used I think he used harmonic functions, level sets of harmonic functions to get the Klein-Masken combination to work. But this is somehow, this is not addressing that point, because we're just getting bounds on the skinning image. We're not revisiting the exact gluing procedure.
If you just wanted to bound the derivative of the skinning image, then would you have bound the two quantities? That's an easier question.
That, actually, I think that is, I think, in your paper.
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so? Because in the end, your whole argument takes place in one leopard spot, right? So it doesn't actually depend on what else is happening. Well, we can talk about it.
I'll have to check with people.
Yeah.
In any case, that's okay, so you might very well have to
do it. Yeah.